My name is John Peckham, and I'm a PhD candidate in systematic theology at Andrews University. And the title of my paper is Intrinsic Canonicity and the Inadequacy of the Community to Determine the Canon. The question of the scope of the biblical canon continues to be a topic of considerable discussion and debate. At the heart of the discussion is the nature of canonicity, including a vital philosophical division between those who believe that the canon is a community-determined construction and those who believe that the canon is divinely appointed and thus merely recognized, but not determined by any given community. Numerous studies posit the former position, that the community functions as the final arbiter of what is included or excluded from the scope of the biblical canon, which I call the community canon. At the same time, there is considerable support for the latter option, which I call the intrinsic canon. With this division in mind, this study explores the applicability of the community canon approach from a Christian perspective. It is important to recognize from the outset that this study is not intended to delineate the scope of the biblical canon. In other words, it does not address the inclusion or exclusion of specific books. Rather, it addresses the logically prior question of the nature of canonicity. Two major issues entailing a number of questions are raised in this regard, which may be summed up in two queries. First, which community? And second, what about radical prophetessity? Regarding the former query, which community is adequate to function as the arbiter regarding canonicity? What time, place, or culture constitutes the applicable community? Moreover, what constitutes a legitimate community in the first place? Regarding the latter query, what impact would a community-determined canon have upon the potential for a radically prophetic function for that canon? This calls into question the extent to which a community-determined canon could function as a transformative agent. Would not such a community-determined canon amount to the rejection of unpopular prophetic messages, resulting in a compilation of popular opinion? How then do we understand the prominence of apparently revolutionary and community-opposed voices that are preserved in the received Protestant canon? These queries will be engaged through examples from the Protestant canon itself, specifically the canonical history regarding prophets who were rejected by their community. Two approaches to canonicity. Before addressing these queries by means of canonical examples, it is helpful to first clarify the fundamental division between the two approaches to canonicity, that of community canon and intrinsic canon, respectively. We have already noted that the primary philosophical distinction relates to the question, who determines the scope of the canon? As the name suggests, the community canon approach reserves authority to determine the canon for the community. This reduces the definition of canon to a collection of books deemed authoritative by a given community. The community canon approach thus modifies the traditional view of canon as divinely authoritative scripture to a more fluid definition, a canon shaped by the authoritative community. And I will direct your attention to footnote 10 in the middle. Anthony Thiselton commented that for him, this view risks making social ecclesial need the basis of canon and truth. And you can note some of the others that are protesting to this approach. Some suggest that the biblical canon is merely an anachronism, and thus externally imposed upon the writings. Others reduce the notion of canon to the decisions of a denomination or community. James Sanders is a primary representative of this latter approach. For him, quote, biblical canons depend for content and order on the denomination or communion in view, end quote. Therefore, the biblical canon is, quote, basically a community's paradigm for how to continue the dialogue in ever-changing socio-political contexts, end quote. Others attribute less fluidity to the canon, yet retain the centrality of the community in canon determination. Paul McLassen states, quote, canon by definition refers to a sacred text treasured in an ongoing community of faith. Charles Scalise similarly points out, quote, including a text in the canon means that it has theological importance for the communities who read it as scripture, end quote. In sum, despite variations regarding fluidity and authority, this approach, the community canon approach, locates canon determination in the community. Conversely, the intrinsic canon approach reserves the authority regarding determination of the canon for divine appointment, which is thereafter recognized by the community. In this approach, the canon is a collection of authoritative books that receive their authority by virtue of being commissioned by God. Here, the recognition of the canon does not bear on its canonicity, but only determines whether that given community will allow the canon to function as authority. At this point, it is important to clarify what the intrinsic canon approach is not. First, this approach does not overlook or ignore the variegated history of the reception and recognition of the canon. The historical information regarding the numerous canon lists and council discussions is fascinating and important. It is by no means presumed that the community received the canon without controversy or criticism. Yet this approach nevertheless maintains that the history of canon recognition does not change the intrinsic nature of the canon itself, if it was divinely revealed, inspired, and preserved. In other words, if the concept of canon is defined as writings appointed by God, then the history of a canon's recognition does not itself bear on its canonicity as such. With these approaches in mind, let us now turn our attention to the applicability of a community canon approach in regards to the issue of community recognition of prophets within the canonical writings. For sake of discussion, let us consider the conception of canon as limited to that which the community views as somehow prophetic or sacred, the community canon approach. If this definition held true throughout canonical history, what would be the implications for the biblical canon? To this end, let us first examine some examples of canonical prophets in the canon, and then return to the issue of the applicability of the community canon approach. Consider the case of Elijah. Although we have no canonical books written by Elijah, there is considerable canonical information regarding his prophetic ministry. Despite later being recognized as one of the greatest prophets in Israel's history, Elijah faced severe persecution in his own day by his own community. Ahab and Jezebel sought to kill Elijah for his unfavorable messages. Further, in the famous Mount Carmel narrative, the difference between true and false prophecy is determined by the divine response, not by the community. Specifically, Elijah's true prophecy is displayed through the contrast between the lack of response to the call by the false prophets of Baal for acceptance of their offering, and the divine response of fire from heaven to consume Elijah's offering. Notably, just previous to the divine display at Mount Carmel, the community had failed to respond to Elijah's prophetic call. This example raises the question, if the community possesses the authority to determine the acceptance or rejection of a prophetic message, what would that mean for the prophetic ministry of Elijah? Another illuminating example is that of the oral prophet Micaiah. When Ahab seeks Jehoshaphat's help against Ramoth-Gilead, Jehoshaphat calls for prophetic guidance, specifically for the word of the Lord. Roughly 400 so-called prophets of Israel counsel to attack Ramoth-Gilead. Jehoshaphat seeks a prophet of the Lord, of Yahweh. Yet Ahab is reticent to call Micaiah a prophet of Yahweh because his prophecies are unfavorable to Ahab. In the midst of further prophecies in support of Ahab's desire to attack Ramoth-Gilead, Micaiah stands alone, despite counsel to provide a favorable and agreeable message and even initially providing such, in revealing the devastation that will follow such a course of action. Yet his prophecy goes unheeded. The difficult prophetic career of Jeremiah provides yet another example that raises questions for a community canon approach. Jeremiah proclaimed a message of divine judgment against Judah, a message that was rejected by his own community. Not only was Jeremiah's message dismissed and unrecognized, he was beaten and jailed for an extended period, and afterward imprisoned in a miry pit. Although his writings were recognized as canonical in both Judaism and Christianity, his immediate community summarily rejected his message, perhaps because they did not want to hear a prophecy of judgment. It seems to me that such examples illustrate a keynote weakness in the community canon approach. Specifically, the community, for obvious reasons, tends to reject unfavorable messages and calls to reform, preferring to accept those prophets that speak only favorable or desirable words. This situation is not restricted to the Hebrew Bible. The New Testament prophets also faced persecution within their own community. Despite a broad following of disciples, John the Baptist is beheaded for his prophetic message. Later, Stephen becomes the first Christian martyr, being stoned for preaching the gospel and divine judgment before the Sanhedrin. Then there is Paul, first himself a persecutor, and later himself repeatedly persecuted, beaten, and imprisoned, and finally martyred. Notably, Paul is not initially accepted by his fellow Christians. Rather, his reception is accomplished only after divine intervention and revelation comes through Barnabas. In this manner, throughout the history of the 66-book canon, many prophets were egregiously rejected. Yet from a Christian perspective, such rejections paled in comparison to the rejection and crucifixion of Jesus Christ himself. Jesus was persecuted by his own community. His opponents recurringly sought to kill him for his prophetic messages. And finally, they succeeded in crucifying him. Even the majority of his nearest followers, the 12, forsook him at the end. Afterwards, previous to the resurrection account, they remain in confusion and despair. Not merely a prophet, but the Son of God, the center of the biblical canon, was himself rejected and crucified by his own community. The inadequacy of the community canon. In light of the examples above, the first of our two primary queries must be raised. Which community was or is adequate to determine the prophetic nature of these messengers? In numerous instances, the immediate community fails to recognize both oral and writing prophets. Of course, in most, if not all cases, there was a minority that did recognize and receive the prophetic message. However, this merely begs the question, which community rightly possesses such authority to determine the canon? It would seem that if the standard is something like a social contract, then the minority that do recognize a prophet would never be sufficient against any majority that rejects that same prophet. Perhaps one might protest that although these prophets were not initially accepted, they were accepted by later communities. But that once again begs the question, which community is determinative? Which community of what time and place sets the canon? On what ground should we accept that a later community is more adequate to determine canonicity? Furthermore, what qualifies as an appropriate community at all? May any two or more constitute a community and thus legitimately function as arbiters of the biblical canon? In my view, these and other questions remain troubling and point to a fundamental issue. If the canon is an arbitrary construct, depending only upon the agreement of some human community, why retain any canon at all? If the locus of the scope and authority of the canon is community-based, it appears inevitable that the canon will remain in flux, ever shifting according to community opinion. If this be the case, what is the practical rationale for having a canon in the etymological sense of rule or standard at all? Does this not implicitly remove, or at least sterilize, the function of canon as rule or standard, thus amounting to a philosophical dismissal of the very concept of authoritative canon? The second primary query also leads to conceptual and practical difficulties. The question is, what impact would a community-determined canon have upon the potential for a radically prophetic function for that canon? The examples and discussion above suggest that community-determined canon would not be able to consistently function as a transformative agent within that identical community. Rather, it appears that a community-determined canon would inevitably require the rejection of unpopular prophetic messages, with the resultant authority residing in a compilation of popular opinion. The explicit intent of biblical canonical prophets, namely to provide revolutionary and voices opposed to the current state of the community, at least often that's the case, would thus be precluded. Consequently, it seems to me that such a fluid canon in effect eliminates the authoritative function of canonical prophets a priori, by way of a community canon definition, whether that is its explicit intention or not. The supposition of community inadequacy for determining the canon is not intended to suppose that all communities in all times and places have been wholly inadequate in regards to the canon. On the contrary, the community has been integral to the preservation and passing down of the canon to all future generations. From an intrinsic canon perspective, the willing community is used by God to preserve and disseminate his canonical revelation. Thus, the intrinsic canon approach recognizes the competence of the community in preserving information that affords the opportunity for its recognition. It is not necessary to disparage the community's contribution in the history of the canon in order to concurrently recognize the community's inherent limitations in regard to the ability to determine that same canon. For example, even if one were to suggest that the vast majority of communities in canonical history have been adequate to such a task, what if the current community is inadequate? On what basis would a member of the current community be able to recognize such community inadequacy? It seems that an acceptance of a thorough community canon approach precludes recognition that the community may be in rejection of the divine message. If the community consensus itself is the standard of what constitutes the canonical message, then it would be self-defeating to recognize the community's own apostasy. This then would seem to nullify the radically prophetic nature of the canon, which seems to continually call for the community's reform and change. Accordingly, it would seem internally consistent with a philosophical framework of a community approach to explicitly reject canonical authority and place theological primacy in the hands of community consensus. In this approach, the canons of previous generations could nevertheless be considered to the extent that it is deemed helpful by the community, while avoiding the pretense of viewing any canon as authoritative, but rather openly restricting such authority to community consensus. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not advocating that. I'm saying that would be the logical conclusion, in my view, of the community canon approach. The adequacy of the intrinsic canon. It would appear that the intrinsic canon approach avoids the problems discussed above, because it views the canon as determined by God and not by any community. However, that is not to say that the intrinsic canon approach is without its limitations. In my view, the issue of canonicity in an intrinsic canon approach comes down to two fundamental questions. First, is there a divinely determined canon? Second, what is the scope of that canon, and on what basis is it recognized? The extensive nature of both questions eludes sufficient response due to the nature of this brief study. However, it seems that both questions might be capable of plausible suggestions that, in turn, afford a working approach to canonicity. Such a working approach, in my view, requires two major allowances. First, allow the possibility of divine revelation, including the willingness to examine the data with such a possibility in mind. Secondly, seek to recognize the scope of the canon based on the criteria of divine revelation. Regarding the second parameter, the criteria of divine revelation simply requires that a canonical book be divinely appointed and commissioned. Elsewhere, I have outlined this approach, including some suggested criteria of canonicity, which stem from this seminal characteristic of divine commission. And if you're interested, that was in Trinity Journal in 2007, The Canon and Biblical Authority, a critical comparison of two models of canonicity. These two allowances highlight the limitations, but not defeaters, of the intrinsic canon approach. Specifically, it is recognized that one cannot prove the certainty of the fact of divine revelation. Secondarily, even if the fact of divine revelation could be proven, the scope of the canon would likewise remain beyond certitude. I would direct you to footnote 34, however. The limitations regarding lack of certitude do not cast reproach upon the intrinsic canon approach, since postmodern epistemology has highlighted the requisite of choice underlying the embarkment of any epistemology in light of the defeat of positivism. For an informative introduction, I point you to a few resources there. In regard to both limitations, a decision of faith is required, which seems appropriate considering canonical exhortations to such faith. As previously mentioned, the intrinsic canon approach recognizes the importance of variegated and complex history of canon reception, yet does not believe that history bears on the canonicity of the writings themselves. This is based not on ignorance or indifference regarding history, but on the differentiation between what something is and what it is recognized to be. To say otherwise would raise enormous difficulty for Christian theology, in my opinion. For instance, if what something is relegated to what the community recognizes it to be, then Jesus Christ is only divine to the extent that he is recognized as such. For Christians, this would have the objectionable result that the nature of Jesus Christ is itself relative to community recognition, calling to mind the failure of such recognition by the vast majority of Christ's contemporaries. Is our or any community any less likely to reject and crucify the Christ if he were to appear and make himself vulnerable once again? From a Christian perspective, this magnifies the inadequacy of the community to determine the canon. Importantly, however, the intrinsic canon approach does not intend to rule out the community from the canon recognition process, which is essential to the functional, not intrinsic, authority of the canon. Rather, the intrinsic canon approach expects the community to recognize its own inadequacy to determine the canon, and thus seek to discover the scope of the canon as divinely intended. This encourages community humility in approaching divine revelation, promoting a healthy spirit of submission in seeking divine revelation to reform the community, as opposed to the intentional or unintentional reforming of divine revelation. A further criticism of the intrinsic canon model might cynically suggest that it is quite a coincidence, perhaps too good to be true, that the intrinsic canon matches up with a canon that is, in fact, recognized by one's own particular community. However, if one has decided to believe in a God who reveals himself to human beings through inscripturation, it does not seem at all unreasonable to also believe that this same God provided means for the community to recognize that revelation as canon. One may reject the epistemological decision of the intrinsic canon model to believe in and recognize divine revelation. But that moves the discussion far beyond canonicity to the philosophical question of theism itself. If this is the grounds for the rejection of the intrinsic canon, it would seem better to address the issue at its core, not regarding the issue of canon, but of theism itself. On the other hand, if one is willing to allow for the possibility of the internal coherence of theism, and further, theism of a type that expects recognizable divine revelation, then it appears that the intrinsic canon model may claim to an equivalent possibility, and perhaps even plausibility. Importantly, the internal coherence of the intrinsic canon approach may appeal to the intentions evidenced within the canon itself. It appears that the canonical writings were intended to be read as canon from the etymological standpoint of canon as rule or standard. Thus, the concept of an authoritative canon is not an external imposition upon the Bible, and I would direct you to a number of verses in the footnotes. Although the technical contemporary meaning of canon may be anachronistic when applied specifically to the mindset of biblical authors, the kernel of a collection of authoritative writings divinely bestowed is evident in the text. Furthermore, the idea of authoritative writings that cohere and explain one another exists within the community already. Thus, I believe that canon is not an external construction imposed on the text. The scope of the canon, which is not explicitly listed in canonical documents themselves, is another matter, although I do in fact accept the 66-book Protestant canon for reasons I can't fully outline here. Nevertheless, from a theistic perspective, the intrinsic canon approach seems internally coherent and plausible. To be sure, if one has ruled out a priori the possibility of a divinely determined canon, then one would not seek to discover and recognize the divinely intended scope of Scripture. However, on the other hand, once one has decided to allow for the possibility of a divinely determined canon, then one can seek to recognize the canon of divinely appointed writings. Although the intrinsic canon approach makes no claim to certitude, I believe that it does present a plausible, internally coherent approach to the issue of biblical canonicity.